From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. You're vile. Those were the last two words New York Mayor Ed Koch said to journalist and former friend Jack Newfield. More than any other journalist, it was Newfield who broke the story of an ever-widening corruption scandal that has plagued Koch during his third term. On today's Fresh Air, Newfield explains the trade-off Koch made for greater political power. William Novak is one of the chief reasons ghostwriters are no longer invisible. Coming up, he tells us about helping Lee Iacocca, Tip O'Neill, and the Mayflower Madam turn their stories into gold. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by veteran folk and country artists Jesse Winchester and Guy Clark. And Stephen Schiff has reviews of two new movies, The Naked Gun and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Ed Koch was sworn into office as the mayor of New York in 1978, and as the authors of a new book about him write, he became a national celebrity, a pop culture character. He wrote the 1985 bestseller Mayor. He was on television so often, on shows ranging from Saturday Night Live to Romper Room, that he was invited to join AFTRA, the Radio and TV Performers Union. Ed Koch's celebrity is not the subject of the new book by Jack Newfield and Wayne Barrett. Their book, City for Sale, is about the scandals and corruption connected to Koch. During his third and current term, a dozen major city leaders and nearly 100 minor officials have been convicted of crimes ranging from bribery to extortion. Newfield and Barrett are two of New York's leading investigative reporters, and they've broken many stories related to Koch, including a story that greatly expanded the Bess Meyerson scandal. Jack Newfield is my guest today. He reported on New York City politics for 24 years for the Village Voice. Earlier this year, he left to become the deputy city editor for investigations at the New York Daily News. For 10 of his years at The Voice, Newfield frequently collaborated with his co-author Wayne Barrett, who is still at The Voice. I asked Jack Newfield if he thought Ed Koch's celebrity interfered with the performance of Ed Koch, mayor.
Not really. I think he was very good at it, that the people began to perceive him as the personification of New York City, as a sassy, funny, wise-ass kind of personality. And I think that was not his problem. I think his problem was making deals with corrupt political leaders in exchange for power rather than money. But I think the celebrity was a sideshow to the main drama of, you know, someone who was intelligent and idealistic becoming corrupted by power.
Can you run down some of the organized crime ties to the people who he was associated with?
The three principal political leaders who made him mayor and tried to make him governor all had substantial organized crime connections. Meet Esposito, who was the Democratic county leader of Brooklyn and whose support was crucial to making Koch the mayor in 1977, was finally convicted on the basis of FBI wiretaps on a man named Fritzi Giovanelli, who was a capo in the Genovese crime family and who was just indicted yesterday for the third time in the murder of a police officer. And it was through a wiretap on Fritzi Giovanelli's home phone that enough probable cause was gathered to put first a wiretap on Esposito and then a bug in his office. And Esposito had many, many meetings with top-ranking mafia figures while he was making judges as well as getting favors and contracts for Mayor Koch. Esposito was finally convicted at a trial last year. Stanley Friedman, the Democratic boss of the Bronx, was law partners with Roy Cohen. And Roy Cohen not only represented the members of the Mafia National Commission, like Carmine Galante before he was assassinated, and then Paul Castellano before he was assassinated, the Mafia Commission actually held meetings in the law offices shared by Roy Cohen and Stanley Friedman because the Mafia leaders believed that they were protected from bugging by the lawyer-client confidentiality statutes. The third pillar of Koch's political support in New York City was Donald Maness. And in the book, we quote the federal prosecutor, Rudolph Giuliani, as saying he believed the real reason Maness committed suicide was that he was so implicated in so many financial transactions with organized crime figures that he could not see any way to cooperate with the government in a limited way about politicians and judges without organized crime believing he was also cooperating about them, and that would put his family in harm and danger. And Giuliani believes that and told us that on the record, which we quote in the book. And as a result of this combined influence, we describe a lot of the city contracts that have been given to companies controlled by organized crime. There's a company called Arc Plumbing that got a $20 million no-bid contract from the Koch administration. And the company lists John Gotti, now the godfather, as a salesman. And they got the contract to refurbish Shea Stadium, for example. And there are a lot of bus companies and towing companies controlled by organized crime that have received millions of dollars in city contracts.
Well, you've just named three party leaders from the boroughs of New York who helped put Koch in office. Do you think it would have been possible for someone to get elected without affiliating with them and without becoming corrupted by them?
I think it is possible. In the election for governor in New York, when Koch ran for governor against Mario Cuomo, Cuomo did not have the support of any of these party bosses, and he won the election anyway. They all were supporting Koch, and they all were getting more and more patronage favors from Koch, and Cuomo won the election, even though he was Cuomo was outspent by Koch 4-1 in the Democratic primary, and all the party bosses supported Koch. So it can be done. And in other circumstances, politicians have accepted the support of some of these party bosses, but then after they won, have displayed integrity and independence and have not acted beholden to them and have governed in an independent fashion. And I think you have examples of both someone being elected without their support and people being elected with their support but being independent anyways. It's a question of strength of character, I think, and of attentiveness to the job and of not looking the other way and of not feeling so dependent on them that you cave into them and give them all the contracts and jobs and patronage they demand, because you have to know how to stand up to them.
You've been covering Koch for years. You've been covering New York City politics since the mid-60s. Your new book is a national book. It's talking about New York, but for a national audience. What makes the New York scandals an important national story?
Well, one, I think the same preconditions that have caused New York City's government to become so corrupt exist in many other cities. The one-party rule by the Democratic Party, for example, which exists in Philadelphia and in Boston, in Washington, in Chicago, and in all those places where you have one-party rule by either party, in some suburban places like Nassau County and Long Island, where the Republicans had one-party rule, their political boss, Joe Margiotta, was tried and convicted of public corruption. When you have one-party rule and traditional organized crime families based, like South Jersey, like Brooklyn and Queens, like Chicago, like Cleveland, you have a recipe, a formula for corruption. And I think these conditions exist in many places around the country. And part of the power of the party bosses in New York was that they picked all the state judges and picked all the state district attorneys. And they began to feel above the law. And it was only when you had an independent federal United States attorney like Giuliani that he began to investigate and prosecute and convict these people, the way you had Jim Thompson became a crusading U.S. attorney in Illinois or Thornburg in Pennsylvania. You think the solution is also, in many cases, a federal prosecutor to come in and clean up the local corruption of the Democratic machine and organized crime.
What do you think are the most lasting effects on New York City of the organized crime connections to the government?
I think that's harder to say. I think when organized crime gets its hooks into a politician or an administration, it's very cautious, and they keep getting these contracts for companies they control, and maybe once every 2 or 3 years they call someone up and try to fix a case. But I think it's less on a day-to-day basis, it's less the organized crime penetration than it is the corrupt political leaders who take over city agencies, and then they, because they're putting hacks and incompetence into powerful positions by circumventing the civil service law that requires merit testing, their presence then diminishes and causes a decline in city services. And the corrupt commissioners that Koch had, like Turoff and the Taxi Commission and Amoruso and Transportation, had an effect just on the quality of life in New York City, that basic services stopped getting delivered in a timely and competent fashion because those agencies were being run by crooks who were more interested in lining their own pockets and concealing their corruption than in actually providing services to the public.
My guest is New York City-based investigative reporter Jack Newfield, who's co-author with Wayne Barrett of the new book City for Sale, Ed Koch and the Betrayal of New York. Newfield wrote for the Village Voice for 24 years and earlier this year moved to the Daily News. When was the last time Ed Koch gave you an interview?
That's a good question. In the introduction to this book, we describe how we interviewed 500 people and read, you know, probably 50 pounds of transcripts. But the one person who wouldn't give us an interview was Mayor Koch. And Mayor Koch, who I used to know very, very well and used to be the lawyer for the Village Voice when I was a young reporter on the Village Voice, when the Village Voice did not support him for mayor in 1977, first announced he would never speak to me and then announced at a press conference that he would never give any writer for the Village Voice any interviews. And he has maintained that policy. He, you know, right after he was elected, he ran into my wife in a shop in Greenwich Village, and my wife tried to shake his hand and congratulate him, and he wouldn't shake her hand and said, "Eat your heart out, I'm the mayor." And she was quite stunned by this infantile behavior that we usually get from our six-year-old. And he's actually only spoken two words to me in his 12 years as mayor, and those two words were, "You are vile."
Well, it hasn't stopped you from breaking stories about him.
It actually has been a benefit in a way, because for years, Wayne and I and Joe Connison and Bill Bastone at the Village Voice were the only journalists saying that the administration was corrupt from top to bottom. And the daily papers from 1980 to 1986 were not covering the kind of stories that we were. And because of the mayor's public feud with us, we became like a monopoly, one-stop shopping for all whistleblowers and sources within the government. They would go to the New York Times and be told, "Don't bother, you know, we're not interested in these kind of stories." And they would start lining up at the Village Voice. And as a gift from the mayor, inadvertently, we became a monopoly for whistleblowers. And we did story after story between 1980 and 1986, that people came to us, secretaries, honest people in the bureaucracy who happened to sit near a Xerox machine, and became a great supply of stories and material. And the mayor would constantly have press conferences calling us names. And he once said that they ought to burn down the Village Voice with Newfield in it. And he once gave an interview to Playboy and calling the Village Voice a pornography rag in Playboy.
Well, let's talk about one of
this feud worked out to our benefit.
Well, let's talk about one of the stories that you broke. You broke the story of the Tyler Report. This was this is related to the Bess Meyerson story.
Yes.
There was a report that outlined that Meyerson had given a job to the daughter of the lawyer who was trying the
daughter of the judge.
The daughter of the judge who was trying the divorce case of Bess Meyerson's lover.
Right. You got it right.
So you had the report. You were leaked the report that outlined
but
all.
It's an interesting story.
Yeah, tell the story.
Harold Tyler was a great lawyer and prosecutor, and when Bess Meyerson took the Fifth Amendment before the federal grand jury about her finances and never even told the mayor she had done that, the mayor appointed Tyler to investigate the case. And Tyler wrote a brilliant 80-page report, scathing report documenting with incredible detail the unethical and perhaps criminal conduct of Bess Meyerson in fixing this divorce case. The mayor got the report and suppressed it. He had originally said he would make it public when he received it, but when he got it, he decided not to make it public. And he released a false and distorted summary, making it sound much more benign than it actually was. right after that happened, a source of mine in the FBI met me for a drink and said, "Jack, I've read this report. I can't give it to you, but you should drop whatever you're doing and get a copy. Call all your sources. This report is dynamite, and it's an outrage that Koch has suppressed it. It's an outrage that he's released a misleading summary of it." And that day it was revealed in the papers that even after Koch read the report, he had invited Bess Myers into a Passover Seder at Gracie Mansion, I think to keep her on his good side. And this source was outraged that Koch, even after he read this report, and he was the only person who read it, and the report described chapter and verse how Myerson had lied to the mayor still invited her to Passover. And I worked on it for about a month and finally found the source, who I can never reveal, who got me a copy of the report. And Wayne and I broke the story of the secret report that was devastating to Bess Myerson and devastating to Mayor Koch in the Village Voice in June of 1987.
Now, this was the kind of story where you got it, I think, on a Friday and wrote it over the weekend.
Right. There's another funny story because I got it on a Friday, and in the mail after, and then that night I had tickets to the Mets game, where it was going to be Dwight Gooden's first starting assignment since he came out of drug rehab. And it was the greatest moral conflict of my career, whether I'm going to write the scoop about Bess Myerson or go to see Dwight Gooden's first comeback game from drug rehab. And I ended up going to the game, and Wayne and I spent the whole weekend writing the story, much to the annoyance of our wives and children.
Oh, was this a kind of hold the presses, save the front page
yes,
type of affair?
Yes, it was. As soon as the story came out, all the local TV stations had film crews at the Village Voice, and we were giving interviews all day.
Now, Ed Koch,
it was a big, big scoop and broke open the Myerson case.
Ed Koch had already spent years not talking to you. Was there anything left that he could do in anger over you breaking the story about his suppression of the story?
Well, yes. He assigned his Department of Investigations to find out who gave us the Tyler Report. Five detectives worked on it full-time for 3 months. Friends of mine were called in and questioned and had their telephone records subpoenaed, and a ferocious effort was made to try to identify our source, and a lot of some innocent people were harassed, and I made a lot of new friends and new sources because people I had never met were scared to death and called in to testify and threatened with prosecution unless they admitted they gave me the report. And the mayor, after spending hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money, had to admit that his mission was a failure. They never charged anyone with giving us the report, which had been sealed by a judge. And in fact, the judge who sealed it at one point became the leading suspect for giving it to us, which was, and he was harassed.
Oh. Well, I want to talk with you more about your investigative work, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is Jack Newfield, is one of New York City's leading investigative reporters. He's the co-author with Wayne Barrett of the new book City for Sale, Ed Koch and the Betrayal of New York. And Newfield and Barrett had been partners at the Village Voice for around 10 years. Newfield was with the Village Voice for around 24 years, and earlier this year moved to the New York Daily News. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Investigative reporter Jack Newfield is my guest. You were just talking a little bit about some of the hazards of reporting on organized crime and on political corruption. Have you ever been in a potentially life-threatening position as a consequence of a story that you broke?
No, and I don't really think there are that many hazards involved in writing about organized crime. My surprising experience is that it's the more respectable people who probably care more about their reputations and have a greater degree of self-deception or deception involving their family. So when you write something critical about a very respectable person like Mayor Koch, I mean, he tried to get me fired from my job at the Village Voice. But no organized crime person has ever attempted any retaliation against me. And even the more unsavory political bosses we write about in City for Sale, like Stanley Friedman and Meet Esposito, whenever I would write about them in the Village Voice, they would never take it personally, and they would just taunt me and say, you can't hurt me, you're throwing snowballs at a dinosaur. big deal, no one believes you. But if you, I find when you really, when you write something revealing about someone like Koch or some liberal politicians who have a facade of respectability, they're the ones who take the most savage revenge. But mob guys consider investigative reporters, you know, an occupational hazard, and don't have the degree of self-deception that I think politicians have.
You mentioned earlier that you used to know Ed Koch on a much more friendly basis. He was the lawyer for a while at the Village Voice, and you mentioned in your book that you were for a while part of the same liberal Greenwich Village circle.
Yes.
And right before Koch started running for mayor, he came to you and told you his dilemma, that he thought he needed to shed his liberal bachelor from Greenwich Village image. Is that where Bess Meyerson comes in?
Well, his media advisor, David Garth, told me with great pride that his job was to take Koch's, in the course of the 77 campaign, that his job was to take the biggest negative, potential negative he saw with Koch, which he was then a 52-year-old bachelor, and Garth was afraid that he would be smeared as a homosexual. And the way to deal with that potential negative was to convert it into a positive, and he got Bess Meyerson then to pretend to be the mayor's girlfriend. And gossip columns started to write that they were may get married after the election. Koch would take Bess Meyerson, who was a heroine at that point, and almost like a feminist Jackie Robinson to a generation of Jewish women, as the first Jewish Miss America, who became Miss America in 1945, the year the concentration camps were liberated, and that she was the first Miss America to have beauty and talent and have a career after Miss America. And they would go to predominantly Jewish parts of the city, and Koch would say, I may have a dramatic announcement about me and Miss Meyerson right after the election. Wouldn't she make a great first lady of New York? I've never met a woman like her. And it was all play acting. It was all a fraud, a charade. There was no sexual or romantic relationship. It was a consumer fraud. And at one point during this campaign, Garth, the media guru, slipped, and he said to me, I have to go meet the Smith brothers. And I said, I don't get it. Who are the Smith brothers? And he says, oh, Koch and Meyerson. And I said, I still don't get it. Why do you call them the Smith brothers? And he looks at me, laughs, and says, two beards, jerk. And it was a very cynical arrangement that Meyerson lent herself to help elect Koch. And it also was another window for me into Koch's character, that he would pander under death penalty when he didn't even care about it, that he would pretend to be having a romance with somebody in order to get elected. It was almost a frightening sense of a lack of limits.
It also explains why he stayed so loyal to her.
Yes.
I want to quote something that you and Wayne Barrett write about the New York reporter and columnist Jimmy Breslin. You say, For years, journalists went to Cambodia, South Africa, Poland, and Lebanon to find and write prize-winning stories, but Jimmy Breslin mostly stayed close to home. It seems to me that describes you, too.
Exactly right. I mean, in the 60s, I wrote two books of a national orientation, a book about the early civil rights and anti-war movements called The Prophetic Minority, and a book called Robert Kennedy, A Memoir, which was about my friendship with Robert Kennedy. And after the events of 1968, I made a conscious decision to do exactly what I described Breslin doing, stick primarily, although not exclusively, to writing about one place and try to make a difference, try to understand how power actually works in one location and try to write so that you can have an improving or hygienic effect on the government of one city.
Now, you've not only, for most of your career, you were not only in New York, but you were also at the Village Voice, which was a weekly, an alternative weekly. I mean, it wasn't like the New York Times, which is a kind of national newspaper anyway.
Absolutely right.
What kinds of liberties were you able to take at the Village Voice that you thought perhaps you wouldn't be able to do in your reporting at a daily?
I really can't name any. I think the Voice was, you know, quite professional. I had a superb libel lawyer, and I don't detect any difference in terms of taking liberties between the Daily News, which has 1,300,000 readers, and the Village Voice, which had about 150,000 readers. It's the same rigorous libel vetting. What?
What kept you there?
I ask myself that question now. habit, inertia, familiarity. I mean, I loved some of the colleagues and people I work with there, like Jim Ridgway and Nat Hentoff, and it was just a comfortable place to be, and a confluence of circumstances led to my accepting the offer from the Daily News to be a once-a-week columnist and a deputy city editor for investigations, and it's worked out well. It's a much bigger audience. It's a chance to communicate with the working class of New York, black and white, and give them information that they might not otherwise be getting through the rest of the media. And there was some sense of preaching to the converted and to a more narrow and elitist, as well as smaller audience at the Village Voice.
Your book ends with a quote from U.S. Attorney Rudolph Giuliani, who is the U.S. attorney who prosecuted a lot of the corrupt figures who figure into the story that you tell about New York City politics. And you quote him as saying the political establishment does not understand that law enforcement has changed. Well, the book ends on a very optimistic note by quoting Giuliani, but I was wondering if you believed that yourself.
I think, I mean, in New York City and in most cities, there are cycles of scandal and corruption followed by eras of reform. In New York City, we had Boss Tweed in the last century and then a reform mayor. Then we had the Walker scandal administrations followed by LaGuardia and a reform fusion administration. In the 60s, we had Mayor Lindsay follow the corrupt reign of Carmine DiSapio. So there is always corruption, but there is also, you know, excesses and limitations. And I think we're about to go into an era of reform. I think that law enforcement has become more sophisticated, particularly Giuliani and the FBI office in New York, in targeting corrupt politicians and targeting corrupt power brokers, building up a database about their activities, their the ways in which they make and conceal money. And I think when you read the book, you will see some of these very sophisticated techniques described, particularly in the Esposito chapter, and how they tracked this guy for 4 years until they got the probable cause to put a wiretap on him.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Jack Newfield, who, along with Wayne Barrett, wrote the new book City for Sale, Ed Koch and the Betrayal of New York. It's published by Harper & Row. And Newfield is the deputy city editor of the New York Daily News, and formerly wrote for The Village Voice. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we'll have a live Christmas concert with singer Susanna McCorkle. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. William Novak is now at work on his fifth autobiography. But he's no egotist, he's a writer, and his autobiographies are those of other people, like Lee Iacocca and the Mayflower Madam. Coming up, William Novak talks about his latest project, the life story of First Lady Nancy Reagan. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker has reviews of albums by Jesse Winchester and Guy Clark, two country and folk artists who are re-emerging after long absences. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews two Christmas comedies, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and The Naked Gun. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Noor Rahm in Washington. President-elect Bush today announced his choices for four spots in his cabinet. As expected, Bush named Louis Sullivan to head the Department of Health and Human Services. Sullivan is president of Morehouse Medical School and is the first black named to the prospective Bush cabinet. Bush also appointed Chicago Transit official Samuel Skinner as transportation secretary, outgoing Republican Congressman Manuel Lujan as Secretary of the Interior, and former Congressman Edwin Derwinski to head the newly created Veterans Affairs Department. In what was a surprise to some, Bush also announced his choice for the non-cabinet post of Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. He selected William Riley, head of the Conservation Foundation and the World Wildlife Fund. Investigators are focusing on the possibility that yesterday's crash of Pan Am Flight 103 in Scotland was caused by a terrorist bomb. All 259 people on board the Boeing 747 were killed, as were at least 22 in Lockerbie. The BBC's Nicola Carslaw filed this report earlier today from the Scottish village.
Lockerbie is once more in darkness, nearly 24 hours after the sky lit up, raining down fire and wreckage. The shops are closing and the streets empty of townspeople, many of whom spent the day repairing roofs and shattered windows hit when the plane came down. The streets and hills around us are still strewn with pieces of fuselage, the jagged edges of metal jutting out from craters caused on impact. The chief constable of Dumfries and Galloway, John Boyd, said at a news conference this afternoon that 600 people had been involved in the search and rescue operation, which has been scaled down for the night. Mr. Boyd said the task of finding the bodies and identifying them has been difficult. Those killed lie in different areas, several miles apart. More than 150 bodies have been found, including those of three small children. Mr. Boyd said there were 17 people from Lockerbie who were not accounted for, four children and 13 adults. Throughout the day, pieces of wreckage have been located in six sections of land across a large area. The plane's two in-flight recorders were found in the mid-morning, and their contents are being analyzed.
The BBC's Nicola Carslaw in Lockerbie. U.S. officials revealed today that they received a threat that a Frankfurt to New York flight would be blown up. And news agencies in London received calls today from a man claiming responsibility for the crash on behalf of an Iranian group. The Federal Aviation Authority issued a standard warning to embassies and armed forces personnel in response to the threat. But State Department spokeswoman Phyllis Oakley says the U.S. is not ready to make any conclusions one way or the other.
Since the cause of the crash of Pan American Flight 103 remains unknown, any attempt at this time to draw a linkage between this incident and the specific threat is premature. However, the possibility of sabotage has not been ruled out.
Officials say the jet likely exploded at an altitude of 31,000 feet before it plunged to the ground. An Air Force A-10 attack jet crashed and burned in Britain this morning while on a routine training flight. The pilot is believed to have ejected safely. It was the second crash of a Thunderbolt jet in Europe in 2 weeks. On December 8th, an A-10 crashed into the West German city of Remscheid, killing five and injuring dozens. A federal judge in Los Angeles today struck down immigration laws that allow the U.S. to deport aliens with connections to the PLO or who advocate communism. Judge Stephen Wilson declared unconstitutional legislation passed last year that denied First Amendment protections to members of the PLO. He also invalidated rules that allowed immigration officials to deport aliens who speak in favor of communism. Stock prices dipped today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost just over 4 points to close at 2160.36. Declines outpaced advances and volume of 151 million shares. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jesse Winchester and Guy Clark are songwriters who have each achieved a certain level of critical, if not commercial, success. And they've been praised by the likes of Bruce Springsteen, John Cougar Mellencamp, and a lot of country and country rock performers. Now, after long silences, both Winchester and Clark have released new albums. Rock critic Ken Tucker says these records probably won't turn them into stars, but may boost their reputations as musicians who are aging well. Here's Guy Clark with Roseanne Cash singing Come From the Heart.
Learn to let go, you got to sing. Like you don't need the money, love. Like you'll never get hurt, you got to dance. Like nobody's watching, it's got to come from the heart. If you want it to work.
Jesse Winchester and Guy Clark have built their careers on loyal cult followings and the use others have made of their compositions. Guy Clark's songs have long been prized for the way they combine hard-boiled realism with melodic melancholy. Like a lot of songwriters, Clark doesn't have much of a voice. He talks and growls a song more than he sings it, but he performs with a lot of feeling and expression. That's certainly true of the title song on this new album, Old Friends.
Old Friends shine like diamonds. Old friends you can always call. Old friends, Lord, you can't buy 'em. You know it's old friends after all.
That's Guy Clark's Old Friends, and that's Emmylou Harris singing the backup vocals. Country music is a close relative to what Guy Clark is creating, but he's actually closer to being a folk musician in his verbal intricacy and storytelling instincts. On no song is this clearer than in the meticulous details of Immigrant Eyes.
Oh, Ellis Island was swarming like a scene from a costume ball, decked out in the colors of Europe and on fire with the hope of all. There my father's own father stood huddled, with the tired and hungry and scared. Turn of the century pilgrims, bound by the dream that they shared.
I actually think that that song is one of the weakest on the album. As earnest and heartfelt as it is, the song is marred by florid, nearly nonsensical images like that one about Ellis Island swarming like a scene from a costume ball. When he's working at peak form, Guy Clark's strengths are more subtle and modest. He makes romantic despair seem like a noble effort, for example, on All Through Throwing Good Love After Bad.
Oh, at time there was, I was feeling so hopeless. It's a wonder I didn't cave in. I kept throwing love all wrong people, never to see it again. But oh Lord, won't you look what I found, staring you right in the face. I'm through being lonely, I'm through being sad, I'm all through throwing good love after bad.
Jesse Winchester was raised in Memphis, Tennessee, but moved to Canada as a Vietnam War resistor during the 60s. He's lived in Montreal since 1967. In 1970, Robbie Robertson of the band was so impressed with Winchester's songwriting that he secured him a contract with the American label Bearsville. Winchester released a half dozen albums, but the best known of these remains that first one from 1970 that contained famous songs such as Yankee Lady and Brand New Tennessee Waltz. These songs were characterized by catchy, medium tempos and a kind of articulate wistfulness, and Winchester sang them in a high, breezy tenor. He hasn't made a new record since 1981, but this one, called Humor Me, contains what is probably his finest work since that debut album.
Yesterday I'm just around the corner. Oh, I was playing cowboys in the sun. I had a little dog that really loved me. There's times I feel like she is the only one. Oh no, darling, you know I'm just fooling. know your love for me is true. Humor me, oh, I would pay no mind if I were you.
On Humor Me, Jesse Winchester has adjusted to a certain extent to modern taste. Where his earlier albums leaned toward either country or folk, this new one wouldn't be out of place in the New Age section of the record bins. It's got a lot of the quiet lyricism that characterizes New Age music, as well as some of the genre's musicians, such as violinist Mark O'Connor, Jim Horn on saxophone, and Jerry Douglas on the dobro. But I'm not really accusing Jesse Winchester of selling out to a fashionable pop genre. If anything, the New Age category was invented to accommodate mannerly music like Winchester's, which never really fit into any commercial category in the 70s and as an unfortunate result slipped through the cracks. Now that there's a name for it, maybe a lovely song like Too Weak to Say Goodbye will get heard by the 30-somethings for whom it is intended.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
And please, there must be something I can do. Oh, please, after all that we've been through, if I were you, I would stay. Give it just another day. Maybe it will go away. Maybe you'll discover why I'm too weak to say goodbye.
This is Fresh Air. Novak was in his mid-30s when he took on his first ghostwriting assignment. The first thing he had to decide was, should he address his collaborator as Lee or Mr. Iacocca? But the bigger worry was whether anyone would want to read Lee Iacocca's life story. Novak spent 40 hours interviewing Iacocca and a year and a half writing the book. Iacocca, an autobiography, became a runaway bestseller, and Novak's career was launched as the writer famous people turn to when they want to tell their life stories. After Iacocca, Novak went on to work with Sidney Biddle Barrows, The Mayflower Madam, Tip O'Neill, and Natan Sharansky. He's currently writing a book with Nancy Reagan. He's one of the writers credited with making the ghostwriter visible and elevating collaboration to a respectable and lucrative profession. When Novak writes an autobiography, he gets shared credit on the book's cover, an idea that came about unexpectedly.
When I was offered the Iacocca book, and the publisher and I were not in 100% agreement on what the fee should be, they said, but you can always have your name on the book. They offered my name on the book in lieu of additional money. And I thought that was an interesting offer, but having never done a book like this, I wasn't sure I wanted my name on the book. Back in 1982, when this project came about, it wasn't clear to me that this was respectable work. It still had a kind of a negative tinge on it. And I had it written in my contract that it would be my decision at the end whether or not my name would be on the book. I wasn't sure I would like the book, but I did, and my name was on it, and of course I'm very glad it was.
You know, I've interviewed a lot of famous people on the occasion of the publication of their autobiography, and many of them tell me about the agony of facing the blank page every day while they're writing their book. And I, of course, think to myself that agony is probably really being experienced by the person who's writing the book with them. Now, when you're writing a book with somebody, do they write a first draft?
Only one person I've worked with has actually taken pen in hand. That was Natan Sharansky. He wrote an entire first draft. It was translated, and I worked from the translation and with him to add, expand, and enliven it. But normally the people do most of their work through conversation with me.
So what do you do exactly? What's your style? You do a long series of interviews with the person who you're writing about?
Yes, the trickiest thing at first is usually to get enough time with my partner, my writing partner. And I go in person and sometimes supplemented by phone calls and tape, get as much on tape as possible, 50 hours, 100, even 200 hours on tape. I ask questions. I encourage them to go on their own tangents. As long as the material is not repeating itself, almost anything they tell me is potentially useful for a book. I find that a book is a very large package to fill. The more I have on tape and then transcribed, the more secure I feel that I'll be able to write that book.
Now, as a reader, I suppose I should feel that the person whose book this is telling me in their own voice about what their life has been like. How did you learn how to write in the voice of somebody else?
I learned by doing it wrong. I guess that's the best way to learn. When I first handed in half of the Iacocca book, the publisher, Bantam Books, rejected it. They said, this is too well written. Now, this was a problem for me. I'd spent my whole life as a writer trying to be a good writer, and it was certainly the first time I'd ever had material rejected for being, in quotation marks, too well written. But they were right. It was literary. It did not sound like Lee Iacocca sitting in your living room. That's what they wanted, and that's what I had to go back and learn. I had to create with less literary artifice. I had to put less of myself and much more of the person I was working with. And I had to make it casual, and I had to break a number of the writing rules I had learned along the way.
Such as? What's a rule you had to learn to break?
Well, I had to be willing to use more cliches if the person used cliches. I had to start sentences with but and. I had to write in a more casual and informal way than I had been used to. And it took some getting used to. I still don't find it easy.
When you're writing somebody's autobiography, do you take their word on everything, or do you fact-check and play the role of journalist? For instance, if Sidney Biddle Barrows, the Mayflower Madam, tells you that all the women who worked for her really respect her, that they got along really well, that she was always on their side, are you going to call up some of the women who actually worked for her service and see if they agree?
Well, I'm glad you asked, because in no other book that I have as many questions as I did with Sidney. This story was simply too good to be true. And for that reason, and also to supplement the book, I told her I'd like to interview some of, as she called them, the girls who worked for her. And to my great relief, and to some extent to my surprise, they corroborated her story one after another, but in very different ways and in their own words. And that was very reassuring to me, because I don't want to tell a story that is not true. At the same time, in every book I'm associated with and in every autobiography ever written, there are untruths. That is, everybody sees the world differently, and my job is to help the person tell the story as they recall it and as they want to present it.
Do you have to convince the people you're collaborating with to talk about their defeats as well as their triumphs, to talk about the things that might be embarrassing to them but are actually going to be very interesting to readers?
That's a good and important question. I said to one of these people, you'll have to tell me also about your mistakes. And he thought for a minute, he said, Bill, I can't think of any. The rest, I've told others that story, others with whom I've worked, and they all agree that they must discuss their mistakes. But we have a way, all of us, I think, of filtering them out and concentrating on our successes. But of course, for a book to be credible and interesting, it's much better if it includes some mistakes and some roads that perhaps should not have been taken.
Now, the book that you're working on now is an autobiography of Nancy Reagan. You're working with her on that. Did Nancy Reagan choose you, or was it the publisher's choice?
Well, I think in these cases, you have to be approved by both parties. And what happened here was Random House called me one day and said, there's a possibility that we might ask you to work with the First Lady, Nancy Reagan. How do you feel? And I said, let me think about it. And I asked my wife, I said, what do you think about Nancy Reagan? She said, just say yes. I went back, I said I'd be happy to meet Nancy Reagan. At that point, I still believed what I was reading in the papers, and I wasn't entirely sure I wanted to work with Nancy Reagan. When I met her, I found that her public image was completely misleading, that this was a warm and kind and thoughtful and intelligent and funny person, and I immediately signed up and hoped she would choose me, which she did.
Now, Nancy Reagan is best known in her work for her Just Say No campaign, and several of the people pages of magazines and newspapers have reported that one of your previous books was called High Culture, Marijuana in the Lives of Americans, and that about your own experiences, you wrote in the book, "For me, marijuana has been an intellectual stimulant." Did she know that you'd written that book when she chose you?
5 minutes after my first meeting with her agent, I said, "There is a potential problem here. I have written a book that could be embarrassing, and I want to be clear about it because I foresaw this happening." And when it did happen, when the press did link up these two projects, I was very glad that I had informed the White House, and there was no problem because they had been told.
So there's no Novak gate here.
No, apparently not.
She reacted.
That book on marijuana, which was my first, was written in a previous era, in a previous period in my life, and we go on and do other things, all of us.
You've written several bestsellers, but those bestsellers have been other people's autobiographies. Your own books haven't sold nearly as well. Do you want to parlay the success that you've had with the autobiographies into being able to write more books of your own?
I'll tell you, the things I would like to write about, whether it's, for example, the spiritual lives of American Jews, mm-hmm. or the people in this country who are behind the nascent tofu industry, I have some fairly eccentric interests, which I don't think would necessarily be the stuff for bestsellers. So as long as I want to make a living at this, I might be advised to continue doing what I'm doing, which I happen to enjoy very much. People sometimes ask me, but how can you stand doing work for which you don't get so much credit? I get more credit and more attention for writing these so-called ghostwritten projects than I ever did for my own work.
Have you ever thought about how you would write your own autobiography if you were writing about yourself?
My wife, you know, jokes that she would like to carry a sign into a party that says, "With William Novak," or that, and people sometimes say, "Boy, you ought to write about all the people you've met." I'll tell you, the people I've met have told me some wonderful and fascinating things, but those are all used up in their books. My life is like any journalist or writer, spent mostly by myself, locked up in a room typing. And it's not all that interesting. I don't think my autobiography is a future bestseller at all. And I think it's best unwritten.
Okay, well, thanks very much for talking with us about writing.
Thank you.
William Novak is working on two books now, Nancy Reagan's autobiography and an anthology of recent American humor. This is Fresh Air. Alex Chadwick is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a rundown of All Things Considered. Alex, do you have more reports on the plane that crashed in Scotland yesterday?
We do, Terry. Bill Buesenberg from our London Bureau will have the latest on what has happened in Scotland and in England to try to cope with this terrible event. We'll also have a report from Washington on the Federal Aviation Administration warning that went out to U.S. embassies last week, saying that a bomb might be placed on a Pan Am jet flying from Frankfurt through London to New York.
And I'm sure you'll have the latest on Bush's latest appointments.
That's right. He's named Lewis Sullivan, the head of Morehouse College, to be head of Health and Human Services. That appointment opposed by pro-life forces. We'll speak to the pro-life about it.
Thanks, Alex. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Looking for a good laugh? Film critic Stephen Schiff says there are two new Christmas comedies that will make you laugh, but for different reasons.
2 hours is too long for a movie comedy. And even 90 or 100 minutes, the usual length, can be tough to sustain. Once the premise is established, a comedy needs one of two things to keep it going. Either prodigies of invention, or performers who can make the mundane seem inspired. The new Danny DeVito-Arnold Schwarzenegger comedy, Twins, for instance, has neither. The premise is funny, and so is DeVito, but he doesn't have anyone to play off. And the filmmakers haven't come up with any place for the premise to take us. The movie runs aground after its first half hour. But two of the Christmas comedies are a lot more fun. The Naked Gun, which has uninspired performers but loads of invention, and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which isn't always inventive, but is so splendidly performed that its ho-hum moments feel entirely forgivable. The Naked Gun, which is an extension of the failed TV sitcom Police Squad, is the latest cultural contribution of Jerry and David Zucker and their pal Jim Abrams, the team that put together Airplane and Top Secret. Their movies always give me the feeling that I used to get from reading those densely packed Mad Magazine comic strips, with so many gags going on in the background that you had to spend 5 minutes on every panel, squeezing every bit of juice out. The Naked Gun, like its predecessors, is a peculiar experience. It teaches you how to watch it as you go along. After a while, you won't let even the most banal-seeming episode go by without peering deep into the screen, hunting down the sight gag or the droll twist. Leslie Nielsen plays the police captain, whose matinee idol baritone makes the fruity dialogue sound even fruitier.
Frank, what's wrong?
A lot of things, sweetie pie. A little meeting that turned into a peekaboo session with bullets all set up by someone who's been playing me like a violin at the annual SAPS convention.
Funny face. I don't know what you're talking about.
My stockyard meeting, Butterwings. Or don't you remember setting that up? It's true what they say, cops and women don't mix. It's like eating a spoonful of Drano. Sure, it'll clean you out, but it'll leave you hollow inside.
But the Naked Gun grows wearisome after a while, partly because Nielsen and his love interest, Priscilla Presley, are finally tedious performers, no matter how lively their surroundings. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is another matter. Even when the plot grows logy and predictable, the actors are compulsively watchable. The movie is a remake of Bedtime Story, a lackluster 1964 comedy in which David Niven played a suave Riviera con man competing with Marlon Brando as a crude Riviera con man. The movie was widely thought of as the most egregious of the bad career decisions Brando made after the first flush of his fame, and it doesn't work at all, partly because the casting is so off. But with Michael Caine in the Niven part, and Steve Martin soaring over the top and into the stratosphere in the Brando part, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is a fluid, sassy entertainment. Martin's gift for physical comedy has become so potent that the movie practically crumbles during its second half, when his latest con game results in his confinement to a wheelchair. But that's where Caine picks up the slack. His impersonation of continental suavity is absolutely luscious. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels may seem slow-going after the helter-skelter pacing of The Naked Gun, but this too is a movie that teaches you how to watch it as you go along. By the time it's over, you may find yourself walking out into the December wastelands feeling Riviera tan and exultantly disreputable. When the Christmas cheer becomes too cloying to bear, I can think of no better antidote.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we meet Kevin Wade. He wrote the screenplay for the new comedy Working Girl, starring Melanie Griffith, Harrison Ford, and Sigourney Weaver. Also, rock historian Ed Ward brings us some classic seasonal rock, from Elvis to Charles Brown to Jimi Hendrix. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone has some thoughts on the humor of Bill Cosby. She recently caught his stand-up act at Carnegie Hall. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. NPR, National Public Radio.